Liv dropped into a curtsy, glad for the excuse to break eye contact with the prism. When she straightened, Gavin Guile was looking at her critically. Obviously, she'd been right. Not many women answered his summonses in their work clothes and no cosmetics.
It's been a long time since I've seen a proper Tyrian curtsy.
After your armies left, there weren't many women left to curtsy.
How may I serve you, High Lux Lord Prism?
Lord Prism is sufficient.
Thank you, Lord Prism.
He was obviously weighing her, thinking. But thinking what? Whatever else that wretched woman Aglaia Crassus had done, she'd made Liv think of the Prism as Gavin Guile, a man, and a good-looking one at that. His eyes were, quite literally, the most entrancing eyes in the entire world.
Magister, Liv, tutor, lord, Lux Lord, noble, general, twice as old as you, way too old for you, not a broad-shouldered muscular man, just another magister. You can go to hell, Aglaia Crassus.
Have you chosen who you want to be your magister in yellow?
Honestly, I'd like to study under Mistress Tawenza Goldeneyes.
She could barely believe she dared say it out loud. The woman only took 3 disciples a year, and she already had 3. The 3 best yellow disciples in the Chromeria.
That prickly she-bear? A bold choice. She's the best, and she probably won't hate you as much as you think she does for the first year. I'd have you send my compliments to her when I assign her a 4th student, but she'd doubtless take it out on you. Consider it done. How are your apartments?
They're better than anything I thought I'd ever have, Lord Prism. And the clothes, I used to have 3 dresses, now I've got more than 50, and my worst is nicer than my old Sunday best.
And yet you decided to come in this.
He glanced past her, and she followed his gaze, but the room was empty except for the 2 of them. And there were no unusual decorations on the walls, just the normal testing crystal.
You said to come at my earliest convenience. I thought you'd not want to be kept waiting.
I think you'll do perfectly.
Lord Prism?
You're perfect, because you refuse to be impressed, Oliviana. I like that.
I wouldn't exactly say I'm not impressed.
You say, interrupting me.
And proving his point. Liv decided to shut up. Maybe differentiating herself from all the other women who came here and were unsuccessful in their attempts to seduce Gavin had not been a good plan.
It seems every time I summon a woman between the ages of 13 and 60, she comes dressed like a Hrothgari courtesan, either overly eager or completely terrified, like I run a brothel up here.
You're Gavin Guile.
Yes, I am. And I need your help, Oliviana.
Liv, please.
A number of years ago, and feels like quite a number of years ago, I have a nephew. His mother was Tyrian. I want you to tutor him. It might make him feel more comfortable to learn from another Tyrian. I know you Tyrians don't have it easy here. What do you say?
Well, of course, Lord Prism.
What was she saying? She'd already been impertinent enough. Asking the wrong question about a man's bastard might be a good way to ruin everything.
What color is he gifted with?
She only remembered at the last second to say he and not Kip. She wasn't supposed to know Kip was the Prism's bastard at all.
Green, possibly blue. He's being initiated right now.
Right now?
The year's initiations had been completed long ago. Liv had never heard of someone being initiated at any other time of year.
How long has he been here?
He arrived yesterday.
And he's being initiated already?
Gavin glanced behind her again. This time she knew what he was looking at. Throughout the tower, for reasons Liv had never comprehended, there were plain crystals set into the walls. For the whole year, they simply sat and sparkled, dully refracting whatever light they caught from their surroundings. But during initiations at the beginning of each year, they glowed brilliantly. As the supplicants passed through the thresher, invariably there was the wash of one color after another as each test progressed, the same wash each supplicant saw. As soon as they drafted, the crystal turned a brilliant hue in whatever color they drafted. For Liv, it had been super violet first, then yellow weakly. The whole time Liv had been here, the Prism had been watching to see how his bastard son was doing. Come to think of it, if the test had been going on since the first time Gavin Guile had glanced behind Liv, it was taking a really long time. Usually it took less than a minute. They both turned to look at the crystal.
What did the tester say when they lowered you into the thresher?
He said something about the only good rebel being a dead rebel, and how he still owed my father blood.
The point had been, as it always was, to scare the person being tested. Fear made a supplicant draft to the utmost of her abilities. It also helped even the most arrogant young lady or lordling begin their studies with a bit of humility.
How about you?
Something about my brother turned out to be more right than they knew.
I'm sorry.
I never liked that part, scaring them. The chamber is terrifying enough, and the thought of failing is scary enough. They don't have to make supplicants think they're really going to die. It breaks people. It breaks children.
Liv had never thought about it that way. The thresher just was. Everyone went through it. It was inextricable from drafting, from the Chromeria. If nothing else, every drafter had the thresher in common.
The noble girls all knew it was coming. Unlike the rest of us. They knew the test itself wouldn't hurt them, so that bit of talking outside the test was the only thing that made them afraid. Because even if they'd been warned, hearing a tester who claims to belong to your enemy's family say that accidents happen is terrifying.
Hadn't thought of that. All my friends were nobles. I thought everyone knew what was coming.
Of course you did. It's just another way the Chromeria is stacked to favor your kind.
Liv, my son might be special, really gifted. We'll find out presently, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's a polychrome. He's Tyrian. His mother just died. He's going to face false friends and unearned enemies just for being my son. He won't fit in anywhere, and yet people are going to be watching him all the time. If he's truly powerful on top of that, he could turn into a monster. He wouldn't be the first in my family to handle great power poorly. The gift isn't a pure gift, you know.
What do you want me to do?
Maybe he'll be a monochrome. Probably will be. I'm getting ahead of myself.
But if he's not? You've got to let me know what your expectations are, or I'm going to fail, and then you'll be mad at me for that.
Pretend he's normal, in all ways. I know he'd figure out pretty quickly if we stay, but I'm going to take him away from here as soon as I possibly can. Until then, give him some normalcy. If he makes you mad, yell at him. Smack his knuckles with a stick if he misbehaves, you understand? But if he masters something difficult, pretend it's good, but nothing out of the norm. I want him to know that those who matter aren't going to be impressed by who his father is or how much he can draft.
And who are these people?
Liv hadn't really meant to say it out loud, but Gavin was being ridiculously idealistic. Of course who he was and how much he could draft mattered. Maybe when you were born at the top of the mountain, you could pretend the mountain didn't matter, but those who climbed it, and those born at its base who could never climb at all, knew differently.
Me and Orholum. If we're the only ones whose approval he cares about, he's got a chance.
Liv didn't know if that was the most arrogant or the most profound thing she'd ever heard. Maybe both. Whatever else it did, though, it reminded her who and what Gavin was. By Orholum's scowling brow, she'd been glibly sarcastic to the Prism, the man closest in all the world to Orholum himself. And thank Orholum that Liv had turned down that awful woman, even if it was going to cost her dearly. Spying on the Prism himself? It was practically sacrilegious. As bad as Liv's stupidity and awkwardness and horrifying sliver of infatuation was, how awful would it have been to be a traitor, too?
I'm sorry, Lord Prism, I was out of line.
Gavin raised a hand and stood abruptly. Liv glanced at the crystal but saw nothing. The crystal hadn't changed. She looked over at Gavin in time to see the Prism blanch. Then his face was lit up, like the sun had just come out from behind the blackest clouds. A wash of color splashed through his skin, and he threw out a hand toward the crystal. A shimmering tube of Luxon shot from his hand and stuck to the crystal on the opposite wall like an iridescent spiderweb on fire. More and more gushed out of the man, pushing deep into the crystal. And then, as abruptly as he started, Gavin stopped. A moment later, the crystal glowed a brilliant jade green, and then a less intense blue.
What was that?
A secret.
Gavin gestured, and Liv heard the windows drop heavily into their slots.
Come here.
Gavin's body filled with every color in the rainbow and beyond. A rope of green Luxon, wrapped around a chain of yellow-infused blue, ran from his hand.
Now, girl! I have to be there first to contain this, and he's going to need you.
In a daze, Liz hurried over to the prism. She didn't even know what he was talking about.
Get on my back.
What?
On my back now! Hold on tight!
She jumped on his back. His body was unnaturally hot from the sub-reds he was holding, along with every other color. What was he doing? She looked at the chain he was holding again. Then he turned and faced the void outside his window.
Not that tight!
What?
Not that tight!
Even as she started to apologize, bands of Luxon whipped around her body, holding her tight against him. Gavin took a run toward the window and left. Liv's view at first was only of the Luxon spooling out of Gavin's hand like spider silk, perfectly matching the rate at which they were falling. She realized she had no idea how far exactly they would have to fall to get to the level of the threshing chamber, or how Gavin would know when to stop them. For that matter, how did he mean to get back into the tower from the outside? Hope someone left a window open? They were falling an awfully long time. Liv's eyes disobeyed her and jumped from the Luxon above to the ground below. It was rushing up at them with incredible speed. Then she was crushed into Gavin's back as he solidified the rope. They whipped around backward, and she saw the rope chain spooled out to the distant top of the prism's tower, and the tower itself was looming bigger and bigger as they swung back toward its sheer, unbroken face. Liv saw three missiles streaking out from Gavin's outstretched left hand toward the tower in front of them. Glass and stone exploded on every side around her. She was sliding along a floor, zipping straight and smooth for a fraction of a second, abruptly cut away from the prism. Then something caught the hem of her skirt. There were half a dozen drafters in the suddenly breezy hallway, looking at the prism and her in disbelief. The prism was already up.
Why is my butt cold?
Liv followed the drafter's stares and looked down. Her skirt was bunched around her waist from the slide, exposing her to all the world. She yanked her skirt down and jumped to her feet.
You! Get Luxord Black! Tell him I want this repaired. Today. Go immediately. You, take the names of everyone in this hall and everyone in the testing chamber.
Liv, seeing everyone's attention was on the prism, shifted her hips. She hadn't noticed until after she jumped up, but her butt cheeks had been cold because her underclothes had been yanked up too. Now they were cleaving the moon in a serious way. She shimmied, trying to fix her underclothes without fishing after them with a hand.
Oliviana, what are you doing? Never mind. Stay here. I'll call for you in a moment.
Gavin opened the door to the testing chamber and slipped inside.
Are you ready to see your colors?
I know I am. Mistress Varidos, may I?
Family members of supplicants weren't allowed in the testing chamber for fear that it would lead to cheating. The rule, at least theoretically, even applied to the prism. There's a reason theory and practice are two different words.
I wasn't even aware that you'd begun your testing. How long did they say you lasted?
4 minutes, I guess.
4:12.
Gavin physically stopped. It had seemed like a long time up in his room, but he'd supposed it had only seemed long. 4 minutes was astounding. Passing had only taken him 5. Mistress Varidos drew close to Gavin.
There was some irregularity that I think you should know about.
Well done. We'll just be a moment.
Gavin came aside, leaving Kip with the men and women representing the colors. Grinning, Gavin walked toward the tester's table with Mistress Varidos. They came to stand right over the stone table. A black samite cloth was spread over a hole in the middle of the table. The testing stone would be right in there. Gavin tried to remember exactly how it was positioned. He'd only get one shot at this.
What was the irregularity?
The samite blocked out any outside light that would interfere with the testing stone.
He threw the rope out of his hand at about 3:30. Before I could stop her, one of the women put it back in his hand.
Are you joking?
They send the beautiful ones for the testing. Half of them barely have the brains to remember their lines, much less remember some of the more obscure rules governing situations that have never arisen in living memory. Even Dazen didn't throw the rope aside.
Which one did it?
The green.
Of course it was the green. Wild, unpredictable, chafing at the slightest restriction.
Get her over here!
The green tester saw the mistress's summons and walked right over. All the testers were beautiful, and if being light-skinned was a detriment on the battlefield, it was favored for this and a few other ceremonies. The visual effect of a man or woman whose skin was green or blue or red was more muted the darker their natural skin tone. Even the Pareans chose coastal, lowland, or mixed-blood countrymen to represent them in this ceremony. This woman was Hrothgari, and light-skinned even for them. She moved with the easy grace of a dancer. Her thin green robe, thrown on during the ceremony so that all the testers would be clad in their colors when the supplicant emerged, which might be only 10 or 15 seconds after their testing began, was in her case open deep between her large breasts. She walked up eagerly, throwing her hair back, back straight, standing just on the other side of the table. The nudity and near nudity of some of the ceremonies were shrouded in religious and cultural symbolism that made them almost non-erotic. Almost, because no matter how high-minded you might be, you couldn't completely ignore the fact that you were looking at someone who was naked and astoundingly attractive. But the parties afterward, especially at initiations, were always a gray area. Everyone beautiful, everyone half-clad, everyone with a fresh memory of everyone else stark naked, the atmosphere jubilant, the wine flowing freely, and the somber ceremonialism suddenly removed. The green knew exactly what she was doing. Gavin was taller than the woman, so he could barely help but stare down her barely closed robe. Instead, he looked at her heart-shaped face, hazel eyes, the pupils barely haloed in green. She looked familiar.
Over here. Who are you?
My name is Tisus.
Tisus what?
Oh, Tisus Malargos.
What happened, Tisus?
He pretended not to recognize the name. Her father and uncle had been his friends. That was, his Dazens. They disappeared after the war, killed by bandits or enslaved by pirates, most likely. She had the family look. No doubt she hated him. She'd seen that Kip had a chance of passing the test, so she'd sabotaged him. Gutsy. Foolish and infuriating, but gutsy.
The supplicant cheated. He threw out the rope. I put it back in his hand.
You're not to touch the supplicant in any way during the testing. Is there something about that rule that's unclear?
I didn't touch him. Pardon me. Hi, Luxord Prism. I put the rope back in his hand without touching his skin. I was trying to preserve the integrity of the test.
Malargos, you're Hrothgari, right?
Yes, Lord Prism.
When your own blessed satrap Rados crossed the great river to fight the Blood Foresters who outnumbered him 2-1, do you remember what he did?
He burned Rosano's bridge behind his army.
Was that cheating?
I don't follow.
He burned the bridge so his men knew they couldn't flee. He gave them no way out. Every last man knew he had to win or die. It's where we get the expression, burning your bridges behind you.
But I saw him reaching for the rope.
And you gave it back to him.
Of course.
So you would have built a new bridge behind blessed satrap Rados?
Of course not. That would be...
And doomed him. How long did you last before you pulled the rope?
17 seconds.
And you destroyed a young man's chance at passing.
We could retest.
You know we can't. Once supplicants know it's not real, the thresher doesn't work. Everyone would say it was because he got special favor for being my nephew.
Oh, I didn't mean
And to... you know it!
It doesn't matter what you meant.
Gavin split some superviolet from the light of the torches. Just a little. The beauty of superviolet was its invisibility. The superviolet settled into his fingertips.
You broke the rules, Tisus. You botched your duties, and you may have destroyed a young man's future.
But nobody passes!
It had become a mark of pride just to hold on for a long time. Conspiracies, the dark, tight spaces, heights, spiders, snakes, rats. The thresher hit all of the most common fears. Usually, believing that failure would mean the loss of everything, and with their eyes dilated from fear, the applicant drafted any and all colors before they pulled the rope. It wasn't perfect, of course, but it was the best test they had.
Get out of my sight.
She crossed quickly between Gavin and the mistress, just as Gavin had planned. He pulled a stone from his pocket, holding the short rod behind his wrist, slid the samite off the pole, flicked invisible superviolet out of his fingertips and used it to snatch the testing stone out of its grooves. He snapped the Luxon back to his wrist, binding the testing stone to his forearm with bands of superviolet, and with the last of the superviolet in his finger, dropped the false testing stone into place. It had all taken less than a second, and Gavin hadn't so much as leaned over.
Well, let's see what we have, shall we?
In full view of Mistress Varidos, Gavin set the Samite aside and reached into the receptacle, leaning over, grabbing the testing stone, and pulling it out. The testing stone was an ivory bar, either from sea demon washed ashore or from elephants deep within Hrothgar, tipped on each end with obsidian. The ivory was precious, but the obsidian was the real wonder. No one knew where the obsidian extant in the world had been harvested or mined or made. Obsidian was rarer than diamonds or rubies, so after every testing, the obsidian ends of each testing stone were removed to be reused. The superstitious called it Hellstone. Most drafters were just happy that it was rare, because it was the only stone that could draw Luxon directly out of a drafter. Gavin had heard that in the ancient world, kings and satraps, and in more mythic tales, the assassins of the Broken Eye, had created entire daggers or even swords of obsidian. But obsidian only evinced its magical properties when two very special conditions were met. First, it had to be in near total darkness, that is, a total lack of light in the visible spectrum. For some reason, superviolet and subred didn't interfere with it. Second, it needed the drafter's blood, an open cut at that. There had to be a direct physical connection between the obsidian and the Luxon for the Luxon to be drawn out of the drafter. When that connection was made, however, the pull was quite strong. Cut a drafter's shoulder with obsidian while he was holding Luxon in his hand, and hold the stone against the cut, and within maybe 10 seconds, the Luxon would be gone. Scholars speculated that was because drafters had Luxon throughout their bodies at all times, so the connection was direct, even if it was distant within the body. Because the rates at which obsidian pulled colors out of a person were different for the different kinds of Luxon, they made nice lines as they were pulled out of the body and into the ivory. If a color formed and stayed and was thick enough, the supplicant was deemed worthy of receiving training in that color. If there were two colors, of course, the supplicant was deemed a bichrome, and more than two made them a polychrome. Gavin took the testing stone. He caught a faint whiff of cloves that was the scent of superviolet Luxon. He held it for just a moment, willing the scent to disperse, and handed the stone to Mistress Varidos. As the head tester, it was her place to declare the findings. As he did, everyone else gathered around. She carefully removed the obsidian tips and stowed them in a special box, and then held the testing stone over her head. There was a clear, thick green bar peeking toward the blue side, and next to it a less full blue. Yellow was faint. There was a tiny bit in the superviolet. It was a classic bell, the most common pattern in drafters.
I hereby declare Kip of Recton, gifted of Orholm, in the colors green and blue, with superviolet undecided, and to be tested further at a later date. Kip, congratulations. You're a bichrome.
Hurrah! Well done!
Yes. For the Kipper!
Only Kip still looked confused. Gavin walked around the table, put an arm around Kip's shoulder, and squeezed.
Well done, Kip.
So, I passed?
You passed. You made me proud.
Gavin released the boy, who was looking at him like he was utterly befuddled, like he couldn't believe the words Gavin had just said. Some of that, too, was the magic. The emotional effects of every part of the spectrum had just passed through Kip for the very first time. He didn't know yet what to do with the residue. It took time. Gavin gestured toward the door, beckoning Oliviana.
I've brought you someone special. A surprise for you. She'll be your mentor. She'll explain how things work and teach you some of the basics until we leave. Kip, may I present...
Liv!
Kip!
Why don't you go ahead and take him up to his room, Liv? And remember what I said.
Kip was still in a daze, so Liv took his hand and turned to lead him toward the main door. There would be a crowd there, no doubt. No need for Kip to think anything was out of the usual.
Why don't you go the back way?
Gavin turned and flung superviolet at the opposite wall. A section of the wall popped open on previously hidden hinges. Liv took Kip out the back door. Commander Ironfist and Lux Lord Black came in the front door.
Lux Lord, Mistress, Commander, Magisters.
Gavin waved a friendly hand to show he was simply too busy just now to speak with Ironfist or Lux Lord Black. He walked toward the back door himself. He needed to get Kip now. He should have commanded the boy to wait outside the room instead of sending him upstairs. Gavin stepped through the back door, already composing the letter he would leave for the White, and almost ran over a dark, demure little man in a slave's robe. He recognized the man, and his heart stopped.
Greetings, Lord Prism. Your father tires of your delays. He demands that you come to his chambers immediately.
Take me to him.
Kip followed Libdanovus through a narrow hall and then out to a lift. His head was still a whirl, and his emotions were a riot that seemed not completely internal, as if somehow additional emotions were being pressed onto him. It felt alien. Maybe it was just seeing Liv. He'd known she was at the Chromeria, and he'd hoped to see her ever since he'd known he was coming here. But actually seeing her was different. Master Danovus had shared many of Liv's letters with Kip, so in some ways it didn't feel like it had been 2 full years. But she'd been 15 then. He'd been 13. Apparently he'd grown since then because he was finally taller than she was. Of course, he was also still about 3 times wider than she was. If anything, she was even more beautiful than she had been. As she led him through a hall and finally to a lift, she didn't say anything. Kip was glad for the silence. He didn't think he could have found his tongue. An odd, quiet joy and peace settled over him at seeing her. He remembered when she was 14 years old, and the rumor had run around town that she was going to be betrothed to Ged, the Alcaldesa's son. Shortly thereafter, she left for the Chromeria. Kip had been relieved. She'd seemed too good for little Rectum. But though he was sure she hadn't thought of him since, he'd missed her. She had been like the sun passing overhead, and he turned his face as she passed, warmed by her presence, but never daring to hope for more. When Master Danovus had shared that Liv was having a hard time with some girl at the Chromeria, Kip had wanted to leave immediately and kill the offender, then come home. Seeing her wavy hair swish and bounce around her shoulders as she led him was like standing in the sunlight again after a long winter. Kip didn't want words. Once he opened his big mouth, he'd surely spoil everything. He just watched her walk, hiking up his own pants gracelessly as she strode ahead, purposefully, at home, at ease, in command of her environment.
I think I'm lost. Kip? No, never mind, of course you wouldn't.
She headed off again, and Kip followed. Liv had turned into a woman in the time she'd been away. She was as slender as he was fat, her eyes large, lucid brown, her skin smooth and clear, where his was cursed with pimples around his neck and jaw, as his beard was only just coming in. Thank Orholum. At least her chest was bigger than his. Kip barely glanced there, though, and now as he followed her, he barely looked at her body. Her skirt did swoosh back and forth in a most pleasing manner as she walked, revealing slim, well-turned calves. But, aside from a glance or two, or maybe three, Kip glanced again. Four. Aside from that, he didn't look at her the way he'd look at some other beautiful woman. It just didn't seem respectful. Five. She stopped when they got into the lift.
I just realized that I have no idea where I'm supposed to take you. Tell you what, you can come to my room until I get this figured out. If you're like I was after the threshing, you'll probably need to go straight to bed, right?
Kip wasn't sure how he hadn't noticed before, but he was tired. He felt as if someone had taken the bottle of his energy and shaken it all out. He nodded his head.
Don't feel like talking?
I'm cute to her. Cute. Ugh.
She set the counterweights on the lift, paused for a moment. She must have been surprised how much weight she needed to add to account for Kip, and added more. In moments, they were speeding up the tower, passing other students going both up and down. They stopped and stepped into a wide lobby area that dimpled out to one of the clear tubes that connected the central tower to all the others. Kip looked at Liv, eyebrows up.
My apartments are over in yellow. Yellow's in the middle of the spectrum, so bichromes and polychromes include yellow more often than other colors, so the yellow tower has more bichrome apartments. They don't have the space for those in the Prism's tower. Are you afraid of heights?
Not
Usually.
Oh, so you can talk.
I can fall, too.
You'll be fine, I promise.
She walked out into the tube. It was 4 paces across and enclosed with blue Luxon so thin it was almost clear. The bottom of the walkway was thicker blue, reinforced with thin bars of yellow. It looked impossibly thin. As Kip had seen from far, far below, the walkway attached to the prism's tower only at 2 places, on the east side and here on the west. After going straight out about halfway to the green tower that was directly west of the prism's tower, this walkway met a great, almost clear Luxon circular walkway. From that circle, there were spokes out to each of the 6 towers. Liv led Kip out to one of those intersections between circle and spokes, the point farthest from any support. She jumped up and down.
See? Totally safe. Now you try it.
Oh, I don't know.
If he could ever overcome his fear, the view from up here was magnificent. Of course, it was hard to look at mere magic towers when he had Liv right here.
Okay.
Trying to be a good sport, Kip hopped a little, landing as lightly as possible on his toes and absorbing all the shock in his knees.
Seriously.
Kip jumped so high, he thought he was going to touch his head on the canopy.
Oh, great O'Holland! What was that?
I'm so sorry, I shouldn't have. It's kind of a tradition for new students, and the prism wanted me to give you the whole experience.
Kip looked at her hands. They seemed to be clenched around something invisible. He tightened his eyes, and sure enough, she had a bar of superviolet Luxon snapped in her hands.
Give me the traditional mop, would you? I think I left a traditional puddle.
Thanks for being a good sport. If it makes you feel better, I almost fainted when my magister did it with our whole class. Come on, just a little farther now.
They walked together around the spindly circle, then turned toward the yellow tower. The yellow tower had been at the back, right when Kip had entered the great yard, so he hadn't really seen it. Now it loomed, both above and below.
I think my eyes are full.
What?
I've seen too many amazing things today. Either this is just not as impressive, or I've lost my ability to be amazed. Because to me, this looks like a plain yellow tower. No flames, no jewels, no twisty movement.
The tower was luminous, but otherwise it looked like cloudy yellow glass. Translucent, but not transparent. Maybe it was hard to see, because the sun was going down beside the tower.
The yellow is amazing because it's made entirely of yellow Luxon.
And the others aren't. I mean, they're not made of their own colored Luxon?
No. The others have magical facades built over traditional building materials. The yellow is made entirely of yellow.
From his admittedly brief instruction with a prism, Kip thought that yellow was used like magical lanolin or something. It nourished other Luxon, but otherwise degraded back into light easily.
I thought yellow was kind of a bad choice for building material, being unstable and all.
It is a bad choice. That's why this is so amazing.
She pulled him toward the tower's entrance. Suddenly, Kip didn't know if he wanted to leave the solidity of the blue-yellow spindles.
Yellow is usually the least stable Luxon. It shimmers right back into light at the least movement, like water boiling away in a moment. That's why they call it bright water. But do you remember when that harper played a few years ago back in Recton and he stopped between every song to retune his harp?
Didn't seem to make any difference to me.
The thing was, he could tell when his harp was even a fraction out of tune. No one else could, though. There are people who can do that with light. To make Luxon of any color, you have to hit the right note within the color or the Luxon won't form. If you are only approximately on pitch, the Luxon is much more likely to fail. You can cover some mistakes with more will, but you need someone really special to do work like this.
Does this have something to do with the superchromat?
Yes. You're not really going to stand out there all night, are you?
Kip followed her into the tower.
Superchromats can see finer gradations in colors than most people.
Are you one?
Yes, About half of all women are.
But not as many men.
There are only 10 male superchromats in the entire Chromaria.
That doesn't seem fair.
What does fair have to do with it? Because you're blue-eyed, you'll be able to draft more than I can? It's not a matter of fair.
So you've got to be a superchromat to make yellow stay?
Short answer, yes. In truth, even superchromacy has degrees to it. You took that superchromacy test and there were maybe 100 blocks with fine gradations. Imagine there are 1,000 blocks with the gradations of color that much finer. To make solid yellow that will stay,
You'd have to pass that test and then have the control to draft yellow in that tight, tight spectrum. The result, though, is the strongest of any Luxon.
Can you do it?
No.
Ah, that was probably a rude question, huh?
I'm the last person here who's going to hold the minutia of tower etiquette against you.
Which is a yes.
Yes. I still can't believe you're the Prism's nephew, Kip.
You're not the only one.
They got on another lift and went down. Apparently, there was some sort of order of precedence for who got what rooms. When they got into Liv's room, Kip was surprised. It was not only large, but it was a suite of rooms, and facing the sunset. This had to be the kind of room most drafters would kill for.
I just moved here. I'm a bichrome. Barely. I'm sure you're exhausted. You can sleep in my bed.
Kip looked at her flabbergasted. Sure that she wasn't saying what he thought she was saying, trying not to let his expression say anything at all.
I'll sleep in the next room, silly. These new carpets are so thick, I can sleep on them like a Parian.
No, I didn't think you were... I mean, I was just... I was thinking I shouldn't take your bed. I should sleep in the next room.
You're my guest, and you've got to be exhausted, I insist.
I don't want to get your bed all dirty. I'm sweaty and gross from all the testing.
The thresher does that to people. I'll get you a basin. You can sponge off a little before you pass out, but really, I insist.
Liv disappeared into the next room. Kip felt a lump growing in his throat. He hadn't said anything so far about her father, but he could practically feel the subject growing between them. Liv came back in the room with steaming hot water, a sponge, and a thick towel. She set them down and then sat in a chair, facing away from Kip.
You don't mind if I sit here and chat with you while you wash, do you? I won't turn round, swear.
Of course he minded. She'd turn around when he was half naked and run screaming from the room for Orholm's sake. It was one thing for someone to know you were rotund, but it was something else entirely for them to see your fat rolls. At the same time, he was her guest, and she hadn't asked anything else of him, and he'd been rude.
So, Kip, how's my father? You haven't said anything about home.
For a long moment, Kip couldn't say anything.
Just start talking, Kip. Once you start, you'll be able to tell her everything.
Is something wrong?
You know how the satraps would send messages to Rectan every year, asking for levies?
Yes.
You can turn around now, I'm not naked. When Satrap Haradul's son, Rask, took power, he declared himself king. He sent another messenger. The town sent that one away, empty-handed too, so he decided to make an example of us. They killed everyone, Liv. I'm the only one who got away.
My father. What about my father?
He was trying to save people. But, Liv, they completely surrounded the town. No one got out.
You got out?
I was lucky.
My father is one of the most talented drafters of his generation. Don't tell me that you made it out and he didn't.
They had drafters and Miramin, Liv. I watched the Del Clara family get run down. All of them. The whole town was on fire. I watched Ram and Issa and Sanson die. I watched my mother die.
I don't care about your drug-addled mother. I'm talking about my father. Don't you tell me he's dead. He's not, damn you. He's not!
Liv left the room in a whirlwind. Kip stared at the door. His shoulders slumped. Tears that he didn't even understand in his eyes.
Well, that went well.
For Oholm's sake, I'm the Prism. I'm the whole man, master of all colors, in my prime, stronger than any Prism in living memory, maybe the strongest for hundreds of years.
Most Prisms only lived 7 years after their ascension. Only four had made it to 21 years, always in multiples of seven. Of course, they could be killed or die of natural causes too, but none burned out except on the multiple years. Gavin had made it to 16, so he at least had 5 years left. In fact, if any Prism could make it past 21 years, he would be the one to do it. He felt stronger and more in control of his colors than he had in his whole life. Of course, it could be an illusion. He'd been exceptional in other ways. Perhaps he'd pitch over and die tomorrow. He felt that familiar tightness in his chest again at the thought. He wasn't afraid of death. But he was afraid of dying before he accomplished his purposes. He stood outside his father's apartments in the Prism's tower. His father's slave, Gavin knew the man's name was Grinwoody, though it was rude to use a slave's name if they didn't reveal it to you themselves, was waiting, holding the door open. It was a door into darkness of more than one kind. There was sharp pain in Gavin's chest. It was hard to breathe. Andros Guile didn't know Gavin wasn't Gavin. He didn't know his elder son was rotting under the Chromeria. He thought Dazen was dead, and he never seemed concerned about it, much less sorry. Traitors were to be dismissed and never spoken of.
Lord Prism?
Andros Guile's room was kept completely dark. Thick velvet drapes had been hung over the windows. Then the whole wall hung with more of the same in layers. An entry chamber had been erected around the entrance, so that light from the hallway wouldn't come in with his few visitors. Gavin drew in superviolet light, and then stepped into the entry. He drew a little ball of superviolet into his hand, drafted imperfectly so it would be unstable. The instability caused it to slowly disintegrate back into light of its own spectrum. To a superviolet drafter, it was like carrying a torch whose light was invisible to everyone else. Neither Grinwoody nor Andros was a superviolet, so Gavin could have as much of the eerie violet light as he wanted. As Gavin watched, Grinwoody pushed a heavy pillow in front of the slight crack at the bottom of the door behind them. The man paused, letting his eyes become used to the darkness. He wasn't a drafter, so he couldn't directly control his eyes. In darkness, it took a non-drafter, half an hour or more to reach full sensitivity to light. Most drafters naturally could do it in 10 minutes, just from spending so much time attuned to light. A few could reach full light sensitivity in seconds. But Grinwoody wasn't trying to see. He had obviously memorized the layout of the room years ago. He was simply making sure he wasn't allowing any light into High Master Guile's chamber. Finally satisfied, he opened the door. Gavin was glad to be holding superviolet. Like all drafters, he'd been taught not to rely on colors to change his moods. Like most, he failed often. It was a particular temptation for polychromes. There was a color for every feeling, or to counteract every feeling. Like right now. Using the superviolet spectrum was attended by a sense of remove, or alienation, or otherness. Sometimes it seemed ironic or cynical. Always, it was like looking down at himself from above.
You're the Prism, and you're afraid of an old man.
In the superviolet light of his torch, Gavin saw his father sitting in a high-backed padded chair, turned toward a covered, boarded-up window. Andros Guile had been a tall, powerfully built man. Now his weight had dropped from his broad shoulders to form a little ball in his paunch. He wasn't corpulent, it was just that what weight he had was in his gut. His arms and legs had grown thin from years spent hardly moving from that chair. His skin loose and spotted already, at 65.
Son, so good of you to come visit. An old man grows lonely.
I'm sorry, Father. The white keeps me very busy.
You shouldn't be so supine with that wheeled wench. You should arrange for the hag to join the freeing this year.
Gavin let that pass without comment. It was an old argument. The white said the same things about Andros, minus the derogation. Gavin sat beside his father and studied him in the eerie, superviolet light of his torch. Despite the absolute darkness of the room, Andros Guile wore blackened spectacles molded tight around his eye sockets. Gavin couldn't imagine living in utter darkness. He hadn't even done that to his brother. Andros Guile had been a yellow to subred polychrome. Like so many other drafters during the False Prism's War, he'd pushed himself to his absolute limit, and beyond. He'd fought, of course, for his eldest son. Using too much magic, he'd finally destroyed his body's defenses against it. But after the war, when so many drafters had taken the freeing, Andros had instead withdrawn to these rooms. When Gavin had first come to visit Andros here, there had been blue filters set on the windows. With his own power at the opposite end of the spectrum, Andros had felt safe with blue light. Since then, the Chirurgeons had told him he needed complete darkness if he was to keep fighting the colors. If he was taking such extreme precautions, he must be very close to the brink indeed.
I hear you're trying to start a war.
I rarely try without succeeding, I'm afraid.
How?
I received a letter that I had a natural son in Tyria. When I arrived, the town was burning. I stumbled across some mirror men about to murder a child, and I stopped them.
Killed them?
Yes. The child turned out to be my natural son, and the men turned out to be Rask Haraduls. He was making an example of the town for refusing to send levies. He claimed a special interest in the boy, but I'm not sure if that was just because he thought it would hurt me.
A special interest? I thought he was there to punish the village.
He said Kip had stolen something from him.
And had he?
The boy claimed his mother had given him a jewelry case just before dying from injuries she took during the attack. He didn't steal it, though.
But you have the dagger. Is it the White Luxon?
A chill shot down Gavin's spine. He'd thought the worst part of this interview would be his father picking through the details of affairs that Gavin hadn't actually had, and thus couldn't remember. A White Luxon dagger? White Luxon wasn't possible, and for Andros Gow to speak about it like this meant he thought that it was. Or knew that it was. That he'd seen such a thing, and that he thought Gavin should know what he was talking about. His brother had mentioned a dagger, too. Gavin's chest tightened. If he wasn't very careful, he was going to ruin his disguise. This was why he avoided his father as much as possible. Andros Guile was one of the few people who would know exactly which memories Gavin would have and which Dazen would have. Others who knew had been alienated or killed during the war. The feeble excuse that the severity of the brothers' fight to the death had made Gavin forget things would only go so far. Andros in particular might forgive him for misremembering things that happened in the run-up to the final battle, but surely Gavin would remember things that had happened years earlier, wouldn't he?
I didn't see the dagger. It was in a box. It didn't even occur to me it might be the White Luxon.
White Luxon was impossible. Gavin would know. He tried to make the mythic material himself, and as a prism, he would be the one who was able to do it, if it could be done at all.
Idiot boy! I don't know why I always favored you. Dazen was smarter by half. But I always took your side, didn't I?
Gavin looked at the ground and nodded. The first kind word he'd heard from his father about himself in years, and it was delivered as a rebuke.
Are you nodding your head or shaking it? In case you'd forgotten, I'm blind. Oh, never mind. I understand your own secrecy in hunting the dagger. Even my spies haven't heard of you bumbling about, so bravo for that. But when you stumbled across a suspicious dagger that some halfpenny king wanted badly, that didn't send shivers up the back of your neck?
I was surrounded by 30 hostile drafters, mirror men, an extremely put-out king. I had plenty of shivers.
With no blackguards guarding you, I suppose. Stubborn fool boy. What was the box made of?
Rosewood, maybe?
Rosewood? Well, alone it proves nothing, of course. But it tells you what you have to do.
I was planning to rally the 7 satrapies, speak to each directly, see if I could sway them. The spectrum, of course, will do nothing.
And by the time you've done that, King Haradol will have taken Garriston. You were right in everything you told the spectrum, though you drew the wrong lesson and the wrong course of action. Which is why you have me. If you'd spoken with me as soon as you returned, I'd have told you this. By withdrawing unilaterally and giving a jewel into Tyrian hands...
Hardly a jewel, Father!
You dare interrupt! Come here.
Woodenly, Gavin sat across from his father. Andros Guile extended a hand and found Gavin's face. He traced Gavin's cheek, almost gently. Then he drew his open hand.
I am your father, and you will give me the respect you owe me. Understood?
Understood, Father.
Haradol covets Garriston, so even if it's a tower of feces built on a plain of ordure, giving it to him is weakness. The right course would be to raise the city, enslave the inhabitants, and sow the fields with salt, and leave before he arrived. But you've destroyed that option with your incompetence. And once King Haradil holds Garristan with 20,000 men, you'll find it a lot harder to take back than he's going to find it to take when only 1,000 are holding it.
The Hrothgari only have 1,000 men holding Garristan?
Troubles with the Eburnians hiking the Tariff to travel through the Narrows again. The Hrothgari are making a statement with a show of force. They pulled the ships and most of the soldiers from Garristan.
That's moronic! They have to know Haradul is massing troops.
I agree. I think the Hrothgari Foreign Minister has been suborned. She's smart. She must know what she's doing. Regardless, you must go to Garristan. Save the city, kill Rask Haradul, but even if you fail those, get that dagger. Everything rests on that.
Here was the problem with pretending to know secrets you didn't know. Secrets, especially big, dangerous secrets, tended to be referred to obliquely, especially when the conspirators knew that spies were frequently eavesdropping on them.
Maybe I should have taken my chances with claiming to have forgotten what the dagger was.
There had been a time when Daisen had known all of Gavin's secrets, even those that were supposed to be just between Gavin and their father. Daisen and Gavin hadn't just been brothers, they'd been best friends. Though Daisen was 2 years younger, Gavin treated him like an equal. Sebastian was younger. They made him stay home. Gavin and Daisen had the same friends. Together, they won and lost fistfights against the White Oak brothers. Gavin missed the simplicity of those fights. Two sides, lots of fists, and once one side started bleeding or crying, the fight was over. But Gavin had changed on the day he turned 13. Daisen was not yet 11 at the time. Andros Skyle had come in his dress robes, looming, impressive in red gold brocade and red gold chains around his neck. Even then, after having been a member of the Spectrum for a decade, Andros Skyle had always been referred to as Andros Skyle, never Andros Red. Everyone had always known which was the more important. Andros had taken Gavin away. When Gavin came back the next morning, his eyes were swollen like he had been crying, though he angrily denied it when Daisen asked. Whatever had happened, Gavin was never the same. He was a man now, he told Daisen, and he refused to play with him. When the White Oak brothers tried to pick a fight, Gavin filled himself with such deep sub-red that the heat emanated from him in waves, and he quietly told the brothers that if they attacked him, the result would be on their own heads. In that moment, Daisen knew Gavin really would have killed them, too. From then on, Gavin had spoken to their father as a confidant. Daisen had been left to fall by the wayside. For a time, he'd played with Sebastian. Then, Sebastian was taken, too, and he'd been alone. Daisen had hoped when he turned 13 he'd be welcomed back into their graces, but his father had barely acknowledged the date. When it came time for it to be divined whom Orholim had chosen to be his next prism, all of Big Jasper and Little Jasper was a whirl of speculation. But Daisen knew that his older brother was the one. How it happened didn't matter. Andros had been grooming Gavin to be Prism for his whole life.
And I was groomed to be nothing. A cast-off. To marry Karis Whiteoak or some other girl to deflect some other father's ambitions. Until Gavin tried to take even that from me.
The hardest part of maintaining his disguise was here. Not in pretending to be Gavin, but in being reminded of all Gavin had had, and that Daisen never would.
So, go to Garristan, save it or burn it, kill Haradul, and get the dagger. Sounds simple enough.
I'll give you letters to the Hrothgari to make sure they'll obey you.
You're going to make me the governor of Garristan?
Every time Gavin forgot how powerful his father was, even from this little room, Andros did something to remind him.
Not officially. If you fail, it would besmirch our name. But I'm making sure that the governor does whatever you tell him.
But the Spectrum...
can on occasion be ignored. It's not so easy to depose a prism, you know. When you return, we'll talk about getting you married. It's time you start making heirs. You showing up with a bastard presses the issue.
Father, I'm not...
If you crush one of the satraps, even a rebel one, you're going to need to buy off one of the others. It's time. You will obey me in this. We'll talk about the bastard problem later.
Oh, Liv had gone to the light garden high in the yellow tower to think, but it seemed she couldn't walk 10 paces without stumbling over some young couple kissing. As the sun went down, the light garden became spectacular and a favorite of couples. Liv should have remembered. There was something particularly jarring in the sight of young lovers when she was feeling so isolated. She left, her emotions tumbling over each other, sorry she'd been so rude to Kip, certain that she was right that her father was still alive, and scared to death she was wrong. Lonely, scared of her future, and now, hit in the face with how easy everyone else seemed to find it to find someone who liked her, lonely for a boy. Any boy. Well, practically. Liv had been at the Chromeria for 3 years, and the best she'd done was have a few near misses at relationships. Being Tyrian, being the daughter of a general on the losing side, and being poor, had ended most interest before it began. The one boy she'd thought she really cared for had invited her to the Lux Lord's ball, and then had stood her up and gone with another girl. Apparently, it had been a prank. The next year, she'd briefly become the object of a competition between some of the most popular boys. For 2 weeks, it was glorious to be the center of attention. She felt like she'd finally broken through, that people were finally accepting her. One of them invited her to the Lux Lord's ball. Then she overheard one of the others talking about a wager they had to see who could swive her first. Her revenge had been swift and terrible. She'd promised the boy escorting her to the ball. The leader of the group, a young noble named Parshan Payam, her maidenhead, if he helped her fulfill a naughty dream of hers. He'd practically drooled. At the Lux Lord's ball, they'd met in a darkened nook just off the main hall. She'd convinced Parshan to remove all of his clothes first, despite the proximity of practically the entire Chromeria dancing, talking, and drinking mere paces away.
So, how much are you going to win with this little bet of yours?
You know, you're not mad.
Why would I be mad? Close your eyes. I've got a surprise for you.
Oh, a good surprise.
She trailed her fingernails down his belly, looked down, licked her lips.
It'll take your breath away. Promise.
He closed his eyes. Liv grabbed all of his clothes and stormed out into the party. He came after her, rushing naked into the party.
This is what you get for your contest, Parshan Payam! Wagering with your friends on who can take my virginity? You're despicable, a cad, and a liar. You disgust me. You're not smart enough to fool me, you're not clever enough to deceive me, and you're not man enough to take me.
She plunged his priceless clothes into the punch bowl. Parshan froze. With his clothes soaking in punch, it was pointless to retrieve them to cover himself. He did his best to cover himself with his hands. Liv stormed out of the hall and straight into Chromeria Legend. Unfortunately, passing into Tower Lore for wreaking vengeance on a boy who'd taken a romantic interest in you, regardless of how ignoble that interest was not a good way to encourage interest from others. All the other boys were terrified of her.
Why am I thinking about boys? My father's dead. No, he's not. Father's gotten out of worse things. He wouldn't allow himself to be trapped. He's smarter than that.
Still, it would be nice to have someone to talk to. Honestly, a good cry would make her feel a lot better. Liv trudged down to Venus' room. Venus crying broke Liv out of her own self-pity instantly. Her usually artfully disheveled, boyishly short hair was smashed down on her head, as if she'd been holding her head in her hands. Her eyes were swollen.
I can't believe it, Liv! I've been looking for you everywhere! Liv is a disaster! Or Holam, Liv, I'm being sent home!
Looking around the room, Liv saw that all of Vina's stuff was already packed up and in large trunks. With how much stuff Vina owned and all the decorations she'd strewn over every open space in her little room, Liv knew she couldn't have packed it all herself.
What's going on?
It took a few minutes to get it all out in some sort of sensible order, even though the story was simple. Vina had lost her sponsorship. The Abornian lord who held her contract had lost a fortune in some business venture and needed to cut his expenses. Apparently, he'd chopped Vina's contract around and found no buyers. Some other younger drafter's lord had bought Vina's room from him, though. She was to vacate it immediately. Vina had been purchased passage home tonight. She would have to meet with her sponsor to determine how he could best make back his investment from her. Vina could end up as a serving girl, but she feared her lord might sell her to slavers. It was illegal. A drafter's indenture was a far cry from slavery. But there were always stories of such things.
Liv, could you loan me some money? I could run away.
I can't.
Please, Liv, I'm begging you. I know it's not a loan. I'd never be able to pay you back, but I can't face going back. Please.
Liv's heart dropped. If she'd waited just 1 week to meet the money lenders, she'd have drawn one more installment of her allowance, and she'd have ample money to help out her friend.
I just paid off a debt, Vena. I've got nothing left. It cost me everything. Wait, we could sell some of my dresses if you can wait until morning.
No! No, forget it. They'll be looking for me by then. And they know you're my only friend. They'll be watching you. It was stupid. I need to go face this.
Mace!
Vena opened the door, and four men in slaves' clothes came in and picked up the trunks. Vena picked up her own bag.
Walk me to the docks.
Still horrified, disbelieving, Liv nodded. They walked slowly, as if they could postpone the inevitable forever.
This really is a great place.
They crossed the bridge for the last time together.
It's a marvel. And I was here for a while. My father was a servant. My mother was a servant. There's nothing wrong with going home and serving. I'm not better than they are. And you know what? I met the Prism. He called me marvelous. He complimented my dress. Me. He noticed me live with all those beautiful girls there. No one can take that away from me. How many people, how many drafters never get that much in their whole lives? The Prism himself!
Vina's bravery made Liv tear up. She studiously avoided looking at Vena, sure she'd lose control if she did. But all too soon, they were at the docks. They said their goodbyes tearfully, promising to write. Liv promising that she would use any connection she could make to get Vena reinstated. Vena smiled sadly, resigned.
Come on, ladies. Time and the tide wait for no man, nor for blubbering girls, neither.
Liv hugged Vena one more time and left. She barely stepped off the wood of the dock when she saw a familiar figure lurking in the shadows like a spider. Aglaia Crassos.
You! This is your work!
I wonder, Liv, do you think we owe a debt to our friends? A debt of love or duty?
Of course we do.
But apparently your duty to your friend isn't as important as your need to defy me.
You bitch!
I'm not the one who's letting her friend pay for my pride. It can stop, Liv. Or it can get worse.
You still want me to spy on the Prism?
Vena's not going home, just so you know. I own her contract already, and I've got a deal with a rather dubious Elysian. He's willing to give me a good price for Vena. Most people have scruples about selling drafters. Of course, she's not a full drafter, so she won't be entitled to any of a drafter's normal privileges. But hey, Vena loves sailing, right? Not many women on the galleys. They don't usually last very long, nor do the other slaves treat them well. So owners usually put women to other work. But I can arrange it.
Not just a slave, a galley slave. The worst of the worst. Liv wanted to vomit. She wanted to murder Aglaia. Or Holum save her.
Or, you give me the word.
Aglaia nodded toward a messenger standing across the street.
And he runs to the captain with a message saying it's all a mistake, Vena's been reinstated and so forth. Wonder of wonders, you are my own special project, Liv. You have my full attention.
Liv looked at the boat, despairing. It was true. She had no friends, no options, no choices. How could she fight Aglaia Crassos with all her wealth and power? If she asked the Prism for help, he'd ask questions. He'd think she'd been spying all along. Every part of the Chromeria and the Satrapies was corrupt. They were all turned against her.
Hurry, Liv. The tide's turning.
There was no way out. No time to try to come up with a third way. Maybe her father would have said no and spat in Aglaia's ugly face and held on to his honor. Liv wasn't that strong. The sharks and sea demons had her.
Fine. You win. What do I have to do?